cosmic nature of being a physical sight, but it is definitely a mental sight. Because continuously you are trying to change the other person. It is only when you realize that his spirit is as free as yours, and therefore you have no right to expect any change in him because of you. It is only when you try to see that consciousness which is present in you as well as in you. It is this realization which gives you a deeper understanding of human nature as apart from the animal nature. We can start with the children. Even small children do not want to be dominated. What is happening today, practically all over India and perhaps all over the world? Parents try to impose certain ideas on the children. Children don't like it. They have the feeling, you have lived your life, let me live my life as I see it. So they want independence. But what happens when parents grow old and dependent on the children? It is the children who want to impose their ideas on the parents. Sometimes one feels that children almost take revenge by controlling parents. Many parents come to us and talk about their problems. Even small expenses which they want to do, the children want to get no, where are you spending this money? Just as when the children were small, the parents used to ask for every penny, where have you spent? Have you misused it? Now the TV sector. Of course, if you belong to a very rich group, that is a different thing. You may have your own separate accounts. But in a moderately middle class family, now the parent has to depend. He wants to do something to his daughter for a particular occasion. So he has to ask the child. He has to ask his son. It may be a very small amount of money. But the child wants to say, why do you want to give such a costly present? He wants to control the parent. Now this is how the obsessiveness goes on working. And this aggressiveness causes pain all around. This aggression doesn't lead us anywhere. Even in the most noble and intimate relationship of husband and wife, we find that aggressiveness is increasing. With the result that even in India, there are children who don't want to marry. Of course, the parents come and ask us. We tell my son to get married or my daughter to get married. When we have consultation with that particular child, he says, I find my parents not very happy in their life. They fight. They disagree. So what is the need of getting married and getting oneself into this mire? So the aggressiveness of the parents creates problem even for the growing child. Most of the time, parents have a feeling that the children don't understand. But the children have a very deeper understanding.
human when you are very young, you may be 2 or 3 years old. But if you see your parents not agreeing on issues, being aggressive to each other, that observation is present. So this aggressiveness, even in the most noble relationship of husband and wife, is entering. These things didn't exist earlier. Because the marriage was not for the sake of indriyatma vimohata. It was not to attain certain sensuous joys. But as Panini says, there is a very little difference between the word pati and patni. P-A-T-I, P-A-T-N-I. What does this M indicate? Patyuno yagna sanyoga. The word M comes there only to tell that these two people have united to attain God. Yagna sanyoga. To perform yagna, to perform life as a sacrifice to please God. There is an interesting commentary on this Pani's Sutra aphorism, where the question is raised, what about those people who do not get married for the sake of yajna, for the sake of attaining God? The lower classes of the society, not having this as their goal. So the commentary goes on to say that there the word to be used is actually bharta and bhagya. Bharta, one who supplies money, one who gives you these titles. Bhagya, the one who receives it. So where the object is not to attain God, they cannot be really called pati and patni, they have to be called bharya and bharta. Sometimes they are called pati and patni only as a usage. So this sense of aggressiveness was not present as long as the marriage was a goal not to satisfy their sensual desires, but the higher goal. Aggressiveness causes disintegration of personality because it leads to greater and greater aggression. Forgiveness takes away the whole sting of aggression, because forgiveness is not what sometimes a person practices out of weakness. Many people practice forgiveness not because they really forgive, but because they are not able to be aggressive and impose their ideas on the other person. The real forgiveness is when you realize that the other person is an independent being, is really spirit, not the mind. He is doing a wrong act because he doesn't realize it. He is slave to his mind. That is why he is acting in a wrong way. He is to be pitied. Just as you are walking on a road, a blind man is passing and he hits you. You don't get angry with him because you know he doesn't have the eyes to see. On the contrary, you feel that it is I who should have been careful so that he doesn't get hit. You see your own person, you don't feel aggressive towards him, you feel compassionate towards him. just as you have to feel compassionate with a physical disability. Similarly, there is a person who has mental disability. He is not able to comprehend, he doesn't understand. By being aggressive, he is harming himself much more than what he is harming to you. When this realization comes, then the sense of forgiveness is real. You can punish him, but the very idea of punishing is meaningless. Just as in the example, you can hit back the blind man, but you do not, because you feel compassion towards him, you feel pity towards him. Similarly, a person not having the mental capability of understanding the heart that comes out of aggression is to be pitied. It is out of this pity, out of this compassion, that real forgiveness comes. Just as it is true of the individual, it is true of the society also. Even the big social groups, when they become aggressive, they have to be pitied, because they are not able to understand that they are harming themselves. It is going to take them backwards and not forwards. Slowly, as the spirit of forgiveness increases, our whole sense of aggressiveness starts diminishing. Aggressiveness and forgiveness is what distinguishes between a cultured society or a cultured individual and an uncultured society or an uncultured individual. In modern times, we have to be very careful about this cultural development, because all around, a change is coming even in Hindu society. We have started imitating others. We are, so to say, losing our own self, our own soul. What is it that distinguishes us from all other societies? It is basically the spiritual values. If the spiritual values go away, the Hindu society will not have a reason therefore to exist. It is not by mere nomenclature that a society lives. Society lives because of certain ideals. If you stick to those ideals, we may not be able to practice that ideal every moment. We will discuss that problem later on. But at least if we have that ideal in front of us, if we are able to judge ourselves according to the particular ideal, a person who goes nearer to that ideal is a better person in that particular cultural environment than the one who goes away from it. As long as this consciousness remains, the culture lives, the culture exists. But the moment the value system breaks down, the moment you feel that our value system is basically wrong and we have to change it, the culture ceases to exist. So this mental culture, which is based on the spiritual values of life, which makes forgiveness as the very basis of our behavior with other individuals, which is the basis of our social behavior, in modern times it has become necessary to emphasize it. There are any number of instances, famous incidences. You all know Dasharatha art drama. has given a word of honor to his wife. Lakshmana bursts out and says, why should we go to the jungle? We can even put Dasharatha under siege. We have the power. Rama says, don't talk such a thing. The aliens don't talk like that. It is by renunciation that we go forward, not by sensuous enjoyments. Rama loves Sita intensely. The people say that according to the particular social standards of those times, Sita should not be staying in the palace. Rama doesn't go to argue with them. He accepts that. So it is continuously forgiving. He could have become aggressive, but he didn't. Even Dasharatha could have been aggressive to Kaikeyi and say, I'll decide that and you keep quiet. No. He gave a word of honor and he wanted to stick to it. So, all along in our history, we have tried to emphasize forgiveness as the ideal and not aggressiveness. So a cultured person according to Vedanta is who brings out the spiritual element in one's own self, because only by that we are able to bring the spiritual sense in the other person. By being aggressive, by being slaves to our own mental modifications, we will bring out only the mental modifications of the other person. And thereby we will lose our soul, even though we may keep our mind intact. So Vedanta tries to emphasize not aggressiveness, but forgiveness. How this forgiveness eventually leads to a higher goal, we will discuss later.
Om Bhadram Tarni Vishnu Jnana Deva Kshadurya Yutra Sthirayam Raistushtu Vahamu Sastanu Virgashe Madi Hitam Yadayuhu Swasti Nandro Vitrashvaha Swasti Nahusha Vishvaveda Swasti Nastaksho Arishtamini Swasti Nogra Svatirvadadu
The sloka can mean both the things. But why do they want samadhi? Why do they want to go to heaven? Because they are convinced that by going to heaven or by entering samadhi, we will be happy. He goes still a step further. Why do people worship gods? Why do people love gods? Because they know that happiness will come from them. Similarly, he says eventually that in this universe, whatever exists, unless it can give you joy, you can never value it as such. A question may come, there are people who sacrifice themselves for a great cause, for their nation, or for their religion, or for any other great cause. Well, even there, they do so because they are convinced that it will give them joy. There are times when a person, under a great passionate feeling, goes and commits suicide. Many times people ask the question,
at that time he is not loving his own self, but the fact is even there he is loving his own self. It is he who wants to get out of that situation of pain. He cannot bear the pangs of separation from whomever he considers himself to be in passion with. And so even where he is committing suicide, actually he is trying to get out of the situation to be happy. So Yajnavalkya points out that things change. Husband, wife, children, wealth, and so on and so forth. The things change which give us happiness. But the thing which continues is your own self, and nothing will give you happiness unless it is associated with your own self. A person takes a very nice diamond ring and puts it in a velvet case. Have you ever wondered, diamond is the hardest thing. Does it need a velvet case? It can be kept anywhere. But it pleases you to feel that I have kept this costly diamond in a velvet case. So basically, unless it is your own self involved into it, the joy does not exist. You will not value anything which is not connected with your own self. Once we realize it, our search will change. Now we are trying to search for joy outside. And then we will know that unless we are able to know what is the real self, we will not never be able to get the joy which we should. And so Yajnavalkya enunciates, Atma Vare Drashtavya Shrotavyo Mantavyo Nididhyasitavya Maitreyi Atmano Vare Darshanena Shravanena Matya Vidyanena Idam Sarvam Viditam. He enunciates, therefore, one must try to find out what is the nature of this Atma. What is the nature of this Self? How is it to be known? How is it to be realized? The first thing he says is, one must try to find out all that has been thought about the Self by the earlier thinkers. For that you need an extremely sensitive mind, both to your external environment and to your internal environment. Unless you are absolutely sensitive, you will never be able to understand, never be able to go deep into it. This sensitivity has to be developed slowly by constantly doing things which will make our mind purer and purer. What is that makes our mind pure? Because love or the pleasure takes place only when mind is in what they call the purified state, the sattvika state. Even the worldly joys can be had only when mind is not agitated and is not slumbering. Tamoguna takes us to slumbering, Rajoguna takes us to agitation. An agitated mind under no circumstances can enjoy anything. Nor does a mind which at any given moment is inert enjoy an object. Now the scriptures have laid down how to remove the agitation. Agitation has to be removed. But how? education is always caused by the preconceived notion of how things should be. This is the greatest problem. We marry and we have an idealized husband or wife in our mind. After marriage, we don't find that idol and therefore we are unhappy about it. In a particular station of life, in a particular post, in a particular business, we have certain conceptions. We idolize it. When we enter it, we find that things are not as we thought they will be. We are disappointed and the agitation starts. The secret of tranquility is not to have any expectations. That is the first step. We must be aware of what is, instead of thinking what should be. You see, it is a peculiar situation. As far as we are concerned, we say, I am what I am. I know I should be like this, but I am not. But when it comes to the other party, any other relationship, there you should be what you should be and not what you are. So I want everyone to accept me as I am, not as I should be. And I expect everyone to mold himself to what he should be. I am not ready to accept him as he is. Until we change this, the agitation will never come to an end. And that means a lot of effort. Those who see and are ready to make maximum effort for this particular search will be able to see him. And this is where the importance of awareness comes. You must be aware, sensitively aware. We are not saying that this is a part of desensitization. As some of the others may say, don't feel the pain. We say that you feel the pain, and perhaps you will feel the pain more intensely than ordinary person. But you will not react to it, because you know that if the other person has given you pain, you are aware of the fact that he has given you pain, and that is where the matter ends. That is how things are. It is not that he has to change. I have to increase my power of suffering, what is known as titiksha. Slowly, as this power increases, my mind will not agitate. This agitation must subside, then only we will be able to see it. Because mental analysis cannot be done by you unless you are able to see mind as something different from you. Just as in any scientific experiment, you take an object and analyze it without feeling any particular mode that the experiment will give you as the result. Otherwise, it will no more be an experimentation. You just are aware of what is happening in the experiment. You may even like a particular result to come, but you are not going to bring that result about. You are just aware of it. Here you have to make your own mind the laboratory of experiment. You have to watch your mind. And if you give values, then you will not be able to watch your mind, because your mind will be giving you that particular type of report which you want from it. Once a person who was vice chancellor of the Roorkee University says that when he was a student at Roorkee University, first year student, he made certain observations and the result did not come out all right. He wrote down whatever the results came. His teacher called him and said, "You are an intelligent student. Everyone else is getting the right answer. Don't you know the right answer?" He said, "Yes, I know the right answer. But as far as the experiment is concerned, this is the result." The professor said, "No, go and try again." He said, "I tried a number of times. Will you please yourself come and try to see what the results are?" So professor was quite angry and went there and conducted the experiment, and the wrong results came. He repeated twice, thrice. Every time there was a wrong result. He said, "Well, there is something wrong with the machine." The person said, "That is what I am saying." He said, "How did every other student get it right?" "Because they knew the answer, so they just wrote it down." Most of us are like that. We may feel tremendous attachment for a thing, but we know to be attached to such and such thing is wrong. So whenever we talk about it, we will talk as if it is a bad thing. One gentleman told me, "Truth speaking is the best thing in the world, there is no doubt about that. But it isn't practical." I told him, "If truth speaking is not practical, then it can't be the best thing. An impractical thing is as good as not being there." We have learned by rote truth speaking is good. Not because it is a part of our life, not because it is a part of our living. So, when we are going to conduct this experiment, in our mind, we have to have profound confidence in ourselves. We have to have profound confidence in the power of reasoning, in the power of analyzing our own emotions, our own thought patterns. We have minded ourselves, what we call past impressions, the sanskaras, not only in this life, but from many lives. We have to unwind ourselves. Unwinding has to take place slowly, but because it has been wound, it can be unwound. Of this we have to be confident, and that can be done only through rational analysis. But then, along with profound confidence in the power of rationality, we must have vivid consciousness of its limitations too. Reason is able to analyze, but reason is never able to synthesize. Reason can tell you what is wrong, but it can never tell you what is right. If I see a thing and it contradicts other experiences, I know it is wrong. But what it truly is, I cannot say. Supposing I see in a little darkened room a piece of rope, I may feel it is snake. So I take a stick and beat it. Well, it doesn't move. So I know that it is not a snake, it is not a living being. It is not a living animal, that much I know. But whether it is a garland, it is a piece of rope, or it is something else, I cannot be sure. So we must know the limitations. The true knowledge will not come out of reasoning. Reasoning will be able to unwind all that we have collected. And once we have unwound it, we will be ready to receive that which is true, and it will unfold itself. The word used here by Yajnavalkya is darshanena. by seeing it. It is not that we are going to see it with our eyes. It is not a vision of the eyes, it is vision of the soul. But it is a perception. Why he is using the word darshana is because it is not a conception. God is not a conception, it is a perception. It is something which you feel with your whole being, you realize it, and you know it as a living entity.
We are going to conduct this experiment. In our mind, we have to have profound confidence in ourselves. We have to have profound confidence in the power of reasoning, in the power of analyzing our own emotions, our own thought patterns. We have winded ourselves, what we call past impressions, the sanskaras, not only in this life, but from many lives. We have to unwind ourselves. Unwinding has to take place slowly, but because it has been wound, it can be unwound. Of this we have to be confident, and that can be done only through rational analysis. But then, along with profound confidence in the power of rationality, we must have vivid consciousness of its limitations too. Reason is able to analyze, but reason is never able to synthesize. Reason can tell you what is wrong, but it can never tell you what is right. If I see a thing and it contradicts other experiences, I know it is wrong, but what it truly is, I cannot say. Supposing I see in a little darkened room a piece of rope, I may feel it is snake. So I take a stick and beat it. Well, it doesn't move. So I know that it is not a snake, it is not a living being. It is not a living animal, that much I know. But whether it is a garland, it is a piece of rope, or it is something else, I cannot be sure. So we must know the limitations. The true knowledge will not come out of reasoning. Reasoning will be able to unwind all that we have collected. And once we have unwound it, we will be ready to receive that which is true, and it will unfold itself. The word used here by Yajnavalkya is darshanena, by seeing it. It is not that we are going to see it with our eyes. It is not a vision of the eyes, it is vision of the soul. But it is a perception. Why he is using the word darshana is because it is not a conception. God is not a conception, it is a perception. It is something which you feel with your whole being, you realize it, and you know it as a living entity. So he uses the word darshana. And the way of search is, whatever is apparent and assumed self must be slowly discarded. That is what we mean by unwinding. Assumed self, of course, is easier to get rid of. Because all the time we are conscious that it is not our own real self. But the apparent self is not so easy. But by slow analysis we are able to attain that state. So we have to surrender ourselves not to any external God, but surrender to our own real self.
as Acharya points out, you should unwind yourself as much as you can unwind. Once you have unwound, once you have removed all the debris that has collected, it will shine forth itself. We do not have to worry how it is going to reveal. But there is one element which Yajnavalkya points out, is that it is of the nature of bliss. It is the nature of joy. It is the nature of happiness. And since joy is always a known factor, you cannot have a joy which you do not know. You cannot have a joy if you are not existing. That is why the word used in the literature is Sat, existence, Chit, knowledge, Ananda, the bliss, the joy. But mere joy itself comprehends all the three, as I pointed out. And it is this which gives us the momentum to move towards it. Many philosophers have tried to say that that absolute state is painless and pleasureless. Well, if they mean that it is pleasureless in the sense that there are no sensuous perceptions there, we agree. But if it was without any bliss, without any joy, then it will never be a desirable state. As one of the great writers have pointed out, people know that while eating the fish, its bones get stuck into their teeth. There are incidences when people even die. One of our own officers died in Japan a few years back because of the fish bone tragedy. But just because of that, nobody gives up eating the fish because they want the joy of it. Similarly, if the final state will be a state which is joyless, there will be no bliss there, then people will say, well, this state is better, at least once in a while we get a little joy. This is far better, even if we have to go through the pain. But we do not desire the state where there will be absolutely no joy. So Yajnavalkya points out clearly by showing that everything becomes loved when it is touched by your own self. It is you who give value to it, and thereby, because you want that thing for yourself, it gives you joy. So what you want for yourself gives you joy. That means the desire for it has taken your joy away, and therefore you are of the very nature of joy. Having said that, Yajnavalkya says that a person who does not realize a thing as non-different from him, his own self, Brahmatam parada, yo anyatra atmano brahma veda, kshatram tam parada, yo anyatra atmana kshatram veda, lokastam paradur, yo anyatra atmano lokan veda, devahatam paraduhu, yo anyatra atmano devan veda, bhutani tam paraduhu, yo anyatra atmano bhutani veda, sarvam tam parada, yo anyatra atmana sarvam veda, idam brahma idam kshatram ime loka ime deva imani bhutani idam sarvam yadayam atma.